Our second case this morning is United States against Birch. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Heather Cassidy, and I represent the appellant in this case, Corporal Derek Birch. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I request that 3 minutes of my time be reserved.
Granted.
Thank you. On March 11, 2006, the convening authority in this case took action on appellant's sentence, explicitly approving the sentence but suspending all confinement in excess of 45 days. Following that action, appellant, who had already served 45 days of confinement, remained in confinement for 223 days. The lower court held that this continued confinement was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Before addressing the lower court's erroneous opinion, appellant would address the issue of harm. Wrongful incarceration is inherently prejudicial. When it is part of a legitimate criminal sentence, it is designed to punish. And by its very nature, it deprives an individual of the very liberty protected by the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. The appellant in this case spent 223 days in unlawful confinement. And this court cannot be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that this was harmless. The lower court held that the 223 days was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because it believed that appellant deserved to serve that confinement. The basis for this, the court's conclusion, was that the convening authority intended for appellant to serve the 223 days in spite of the fact that the convening authority, in its plain and unambiguous action, suspended all confinement in excess of 45 days. In order to reach this conclusion, the lower court had to violate the law set forth by this court in United States versus Wilson. In United States versus Wilson, this court held that when a convening authority takes a plain and unambiguous action, that its meaning must be given effect. Now, the lower court tried to distinguish the application of Wilson to its review for harm in this case, although there is no such distinction set forth in United States.
If you were correct, what is the norm on the law part of this? What is the norm? Is there a normative method of remediation for holding someone past their the time they should be serving?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Is there a normative process when someone is held beyond their date of release? What's the ordinary course of action, if any, that they should take to gain redress?
Oh, that the individual should take
care
of? And he's not talking, I don't think that Judge Baker's talking about what you're arguing we should do in this case. I think he's asking, is there a rule or a process that other courts use?
In the civilian system, for example, an answer might be a 1983 suit or something.
Correct.
I'm not asking. You're supposed to say what the answer is.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, though.
You're doing great.
Your Honor,
my question relates to military.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant is unaware that there is any procedure set in place. That certainly in the civilian court, this is typically addressed under a tort action under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. But appellant doesn't have that available to him in this case. So appellant would argue that...
And it's not available because of Ferries or...
Under the Ferries Doctrine, yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, let's follow up on that. Served 223 days in confinement beyond the 45 days. Was he on active duty at that time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was he entitled to pay?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did he forfeit pay during that period?
The pay was waived to the wife in this case.
So all the pay was given at that point?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's no remediation that can be given as to pay at that point?
No, Your Honor. In fact, as to the issue of relief, appellant would ask this court to disapprove the entire sentence because that's the only way to afford him meaningful relief. And in light of this...
What else? He was reduced as well, wasn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
So he received E-1 pay?
It's true, Your Honor. He could
be... receive more pay if that was disapproved or whatever?
Appellant believes so. He would be entitled to some pay if this court disapproved the confinement or adjusted the reduction. However, given the egregious nature of this error and the fact that appellant spent 223 days in unlawful confinement, appellant would argue that it warrants a very substantial amount of relief.
So to clarify your argument, is your argument that the lower court, number one, erred in its view with respect to how to interpret Wilson? Number two, the lower court erred in its conclusion that no relief could be granted because, at a minimum, some relief could be granted with respect to forfeitures. And three, your argument is that that's insufficient in this case because of the nature of the injury. Is that where we stand in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant doesn't believe, unless the lower court or this court reads it that way, but that the lower court ever addressed the issue of relief because they found there was no harm in the first place. But yes, if relief were to is because relief is warranted, the nature of the relief needs to be something that addresses the error, which was.
Have you quantified what the monetary relief would be with respect to disapproval of forfeitures in this case, and why? And are you in a position to argue us as to why that would be insufficient to compensate him, or not compensate him, but to take corrective action with respect to the error?
No, Your Honor. And again, appellant acknowledges that the only way appellant would be entitled to monetary relief is if the reduction in pay grade was altered by this court or disapproved, and appellant has not calculated what the difference in pay appellant would be entitled to if the court were to do that.
Is that a matter upon which this court can take judicial notice, that is, the pay tables and the differences?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But again, appellant...
Do we possess the power to reform sentences? The CCAs certainly do. Do we...
To reform sentences.
To determine what it, you know, it's Hornbook law that we don't determine sentence appropriateness. So where does that leave you?
Your Honor, appellant believes that this court set precedent under United States versus Suzuki to provide relief so long, and it, instead of returning this, which the court could do, to the lower court to provide relief, but appellant would argue that it's not appropriate in this case, given the fact that the lower court didn't even believe that this was a harmful error.
Well, do you have any question in your mind that if we told the lower court that it was wrong, that it would have no choice but to agree that it was wrong and do what we ask, which is reassess the sentence?
Yes, Your Honor. But because this court can grant relief, appellant would ask this court to do so, even though the lower court certainly would be obligated to reassess the sentence.
Does this court ordinarily, I understand you can point to Suzuki, but does this court ordinarily reassess sentences,
no,
or is that ordinarily something that's done by the CCA?
It is ordinarily something the lower court would do, Your Honor. Ultimately, the lower court's analysis never addressed the issue of whether appellant was harmed. And this court cannot uphold a decision that, one, allows a reviewing authority to substitute its belief about whether an appellant deserves relief from an adjudged sentence, or the discretion of the convening authority to make that determination. Unless there are any additional questions, that concludes appellant's argument.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I am Major James Wyrick, along with Colonel Louis Puglio, on behalf of the government. The question before the court today is whether when the lower court made a determination that there was an error in a convening authority's action, is that court limited to looking only at the convening authority's action in determining the harm from that error, or may the entire record be assessed?
Is there anything in the record that indicates that the convening authority did not intend to do what he did? There is a letter dated 4 January 06 that simply states the findings and the consequences thereof. And there's something from 3rd MAWCC that says vacate, but he's not the convening authority. Is there anything in here that indicates convening authority did not intend to do what he did on the face of his action?
both the 23 January 06 adoption of the withdrawal hearing by the convening authority and the order returning appellant to the brig on 24 January 06. Those would suggest that the convening authority intended to do other than what was finally reduced to writing in the convening authority's action.
Well, Counsel, go ahead.
Under Wilson, do we look further than the plain patent? Is the action ambiguous?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay.
It is unambiguous.
So where do we look any further?
Your Honor, definitely in light of Wilson, it would have been improper for the lower court to approve any confinement in excess of 45 days. The lower court did not do so. Additionally, it would have been inappropriate for the lower court to remand this to the convening authority for corrective action. The lower court did not do that. The lower court only approved what was facially unambiguous in the convening authority's action, which is what is required under Wilson. Wilson does not address an assessment of harm, and that must be done after the recognition of error.
And there's no harm in sitting in jail for 200 plus days when the convening authority says go home.
Well, as the lower court found, Your Honor, that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that this was not a wrongful.
They found it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, as I read their decision, because they really didn't think the convening authority meant what he said.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's where they find error in the convening authority's action.
Well, Counsel, why would the United States government come up here and make the argument that even though the court has said that if a convening authority's action is unambiguous, that you give it effect, and then come and argue that you give it effect for some nebulous purpose because you don't have to give it effect in terms of what you actually do to the person?
Precisely because, Your Honor, the government is arguing that the lower court took the correct steps in coming to their conclusion, that the entire record has to be looked at when assessing the harm that comes from an error. That would be the same with any type of error.
Would Wilson stand for anything then if every case where the CA action was unambiguous and the CCAs would then just look at the whole record anyway and say, well, it's always harmless if there's other stuff? Doesn't Wilson stand for the proposition that you don't look beyond the four corners of the action?
Yes, Your Honor, for what can be approved.
But does it matter what can be approved if that's undone at the CCA or in some other way in terms of what they actually get? I mean, you're arguing to us that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt for someone to be confined for a period of time in excess of what was approved by the convening authority because looking at the entire record, you don't think that that's really what the convening authority meant. And I mean, I don't see how that follows as a matter of logic.
Your Honor, that's the same logic that flows from any harm analysis after any deprivation of right, whether it be post-trial processing or denial of the confrontation right. The court would still look at the entire record, determine that that was harm. And just because the court finds that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt does not mean that the post-trial delay or the lack of confrontation is somehow approved of by the court. It's just found that that's harmless.
But I mean, look at it this way, right? The convening authority's action, I mean, I think we can all agree that if you look outside the four corners of the record, you could find all sorts of things that the convening authority may or may not have meant. But we've said, and this is different than the other instances that you're talking about, right? Because we've said, no, you look at what he said, and if it's unambiguous, then that's what you give effect to, okay? And so it's not like the other examples that you're giving that we can't look to precisely what it was that was supposed to be given effect and say precisely whether that did or did not happen. I mean, it's easy to quantify. It's easy to say exactly what the harm was. And if you look outside the record, it makes the initial determination that this was his unambiguous intent completely meaningless. Did you see why that is? I mean, what difference does it make whether we give effect or don't give effect to an unambiguous convening authority's action if it's completely undone by looking at everything in the record as to what he should have gotten.
Well, Your Honor, the difference, and significantly in this case, that would have allowed the lower court to approve the entire sentence to confinement. Obviously, the lower court could not do that, and they did not do that.
But they said it was no harm that he in fact served the entire sentence. I mean, you're drawing distinctions that are pretty surprising.
Yes, Your Honor, those are the distinctions, however, that are drawn when assessing for error.
So your argument is that the accused really won in this case because he can now go to an employer and say, look, I was only sentenced for 45 days. That's the only sentence that was approved in this case.
Well, I think it might go
I wasn't harmed.
A little bit far to say that the accused won in this case, sir, but at least, Your Honor, to say that only 45 days were approved, in that sense, yes.
It appears to me that the CCA decision is based on the fact that the convening authority made a mistake, and because of that mistake, there was no harm. And I just don't see how a mistake can negate the prejudice that was caused by a constitutional violation. I mean, how does the government get around that? The lower court found a constitutional violation, a due process violation. And as a result of that violation, the individual was wrongfully imprisoned for 200 and whatever the number of days were. The CCA then came back and said, well, that was a mistake. If we look at the entire record, he obviously didn't intend that. How does that negate the harm that flowed from what they've already said was a constitutional violation, the harm caused to the individual?
Your Honor, that would be the same way in which this court or any of the lower courts would address post-trial processing. There would definitely be found an error because of the delay in post-trial processing. Yet that same court could look at the amount of time and determine that error was harmless.
But in post-trial processing, we also look to oppressive incarceration as an indication of prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor, that would definitely be one of the
And would not a person who has been in prison wrongfully for 226 days and where the court has already found that to be a constitutional violation, would that not constitute oppressive incarceration?
Your Honor, that would definitely be one of the factors to be weighed in the determination for post-trial processing error. And, well, harm arising from that post-trial processing error.
Or prejudice in a constitutional determination.
Yes, if that harm was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
And counsel, let's try this. How does the convening authority's intent, whatever it is, good, bad, or indifferent, negate the harm?
It may not be the convening authority's intent. Exactly, Your Honor. It may be that, as the lower court found, that this confinement was not wrongful, that the confinement was as a result of a violation by appellant of his pretrial agreement, a withdrawal from that pretrial agreement by the convening authority that was conducted in an impartial hearing, and that it was in accord with the terms of the pretrial agreement. What resulted in the extra.
But it was not confinement that was approved by the convening authority's action. And at least the last time I checked, people aren't allowed to be placed in the brig because they did something bad.
Absolutely.
Without a sentence.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's why the lower court correctly found error.
I mean, I don't find what happened in terms of the convening authority may have thought many things, all right, and I doubt very much that if we were to go back and look into the convening authority's mind that he had any understanding of that his convening authority's action was going to mean that the person was unlawfully confined. Okay, so it's a due process violation, but I doubt very much that the convening authority was acting in an egregious manner. But I think that the argument that the United States government is making here is pretty egregious. I mean, it is.
Yes, Your Honor, but as this court found in, for example, a Ruth rule, where there was a denial of the right to confrontation, this court thereafter did a harmless beyond reasonable doubt analysis and found that it was harmless. That does not mean this court, obviously, was endorsing the introduction of statements in violation of constitutional rights. But that still does not mean that the court could not, as it correctly did, find that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Again, counsel, go back to my question. Were you finished, Judge Ryan? A case like that, the court finds there's no harm. In this case, where do we find no harm in the 223 days or 225 days of confinement? Your answer to me, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, was nonetheless you find it in the convening authority's intent. Because your answer to me was, well, the convening authority really intended to get him for what he did in his post-trial misconduct, and therefore it's deserved.
Well, the answer more specifically may lie in the process by which confinement was, appellant was placed in confinement. As the lower court found, the process was, it was a fair and impartial hearing in concert with the provisions of the pretrial agreement. Yes, that does blend with the convening authority's intent, because the convening authority ultimately has to withdraw from that pretrial agreement and order the appellant back into confinement. But it's really the process. The appellant was not denied due process in the hearings that he received. That's why the error in the convening authority's action.
Well, who has the authority to act on the result of those hearings?
The convening authority.
And what did the convening authority order in this case?
The convening authority adopted those hearings on 23 January, and then on the 24th ordered appellant back into confinement.
And then what did the convening authority do?
Later on 11 March, the convening authority issued his convening authority's action, wherein he approved only 45 days of confinement.
But you're arguing that that's a nullity because there was good process beforehand.
The government's arguing that, as the lower court correctly found, that that was an error for the convening authority because it's completely inconsistent with the convening authority's action.
He asked this court to overrule Wilson. Has the government asked this court to overrule Wilson?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. It would, as Wilson applies to the parole evidence rule for interpretation of convening authority's actions. If it's facially unambiguous, it should not be changed.
Well, what meaning is Wilson left with respect to this case if we took the government's argument and agreed with you? I mean, what difference does it make whether a convening authority's action is ambiguous or unambiguous, whether we take it at its face value or look at things outside the record, if at the end of the day it doesn't matter what sentence is actually imposed, as long as outside the record it's what the convening authority meant them to get?
Admittedly, Your Honor, under this factual scenario, Wilson does not have that much effect. Other than, as I previously mentioned, the lower court would have been in error if they had remanded this convening authority's action for further action or explanation, or the lower court had approved anything in addition to that 45 days of confinement, which was unambiguous.
Isn't the convening authority's action a matter of command prerogative?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Does the convening authority have to justify his action to anyone?
No, Your Honor.
Does he have to give any reasons why he did or did not do anything in his action to any other party?
Absolutely not.
All right. Now, the CCA has taken upon itself, it appears, to divine the intent of the convening authority, which is, by definition, a matter of command prerogative, which he need not justify to anyone. He did it. You agree it's unambiguous. But the CCA's taken it upon itself to say, nah, he didn't really mean that. He meant something else. So this whole thing's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Doesn't that totally undercut not only Wilson, but the very idea, the very essence of what convening authorities do when they exercise that prerogative?
Short answer is no, Your Honor. That is not what the lower court did, in that they did not approve any amount of confinement in excess of that 45 days. That would have been usurping the convening authority's command prerogative.
No, they simply defined his intent and said it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and didn't mean it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
On the off chance that the court concludes that the CCA erred in this case, could you discuss the issue of prejudice, particularly with respect to what type of relief might be available at the CCA if we remand it to them for further consideration?
Yes, Your Honor, if this court was to find as a matter of law that this was prejudice and it was remanded to the lower court for a remedy.
Right. What remedies would be available at the lower court?
Disapproving the 45 days of confinement would be a remedy, and disapproving the reduction. So you would have the difference between E1 pay and E4 pay and the pay during that time, the 45 days of original adjudication.
Wouldn't disapproving the BCD at least be an option for the CCA? In other words, if this issue is related to the ultimate question of sentence appropriateness, would it be for us to decide that the BCD is on the table or off the table, or should that be something that the CCA should decide?
That is always an option for the CCA, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, the government requests that this court affirm the findings and sentence below.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
No, Your Honor, unless the court has further questions, Helen has no rebuttal argument.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will stand in recess until 11:15 a.m., at which time we will convene in special session to honor one of our longtime employees, a Marine veteran, former president of the FBA, Jim Richardson. Convene at 11:15 a.m. for that.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 11:15 a.m.